Erev Tov. Erev Tov. I'd like to welcome you all here to Pardes, and I'd just like to, before the program really begins, I would like to do the commercials before the program. What I'd like to just mention is a few programs that are going to be happening here at Pardes in the near future. The first is our community education spring semester, which is, I know we don't really have winter in the community education side of Pardes. We go straight from the fall semester to the spring semester. So in case you weren't really feeling spring, come here and you will be able to feel the spring. And we're starting already on Monday with a whole new season of classes. And the leaflets which say spring on them are on your seats. So take a look at what we have there. Morning Shiorim, classes 3 mornings a week, Monday, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. We have a tour with text program and also a lunch and learn on Thursdays, learning Parashat HaShavua. And everybody is welcome to join, and we'd love it if you would participate. A second event that I want to mention, which is taking place 2 weeks in 2 weeks' time, is a new lecture series, the 2014 Hirschdorfer Kantrowitz Brettler Lecture Series with Professor Mark Brettler, and he's going to be talking about fact or fiction, truth and history in the Bible. And this is a four-part lecture series on Wednesday nights. It's starting on January the 8th for 4 consecutive weeks on Wednesday evenings. And everybody's invited to sign up online the same way as you signed up for this evening's lecture. And every single year, the Brettler series is a really huge crowd and a real intellectual treat. So we're looking forward to this year's lectures as well. And we hope you'll join us once again. I'll remind you, it's starting on January the 8th. And last of all, I just want people to know that we have our guests here from the Winter Pardes Executive Seminar, the participants who have been here all week studying. And I just want people to know that we will be having our executive seminar this year from June 29th to July the 3rd. And the topic is going to be Rav Kook. It's going to be a week of study about Rav Kook, Zionist, revolutionary, mystic, universalist. And this is an intensive week of study. This program has been growing from year to year. It's a tremendous executive seminar, and if you're interested in it, you can look. If you're interested in it, there is a pile of leaflets right outside the door, and you can pick one up on your way out. Okay, that's the end of the commercials, and now I will pass the microphone over.
A very assertive audience. Okay, everything else okay? Okay, they can't see you. You have to move. Okay. How's that? Okay, great. Erev Tov, welcome. My name is Michael Rosenzweig. It's my privilege to be the president and CEO of Pardes. And it's my even greater privilege to welcome you here tonight. It's really a wonderful crowd. We're delighted to see you. This is a very special evening. on October 1st of this year, the Religion and Public Life Project of the Pew Research Center issued a now famous report, some would say infamous report, entitled A Portrait of Jewish Americans. It became instantly controversial, instantly interesting, and instantly talked about, if not read in its entirety. In its entirety, it's actually a pretty lengthy document. Many of you, I'm sure, have read at least the summary, and some of you may actually have read the entire document. But some of the findings that were reported soon after its issuance grabbed the attention of American Jews and, to some extent, world Jewry. Some of them are as follows. These are the ones that really caught people's attention. Almost one-third of Jewish Americans born after 1980 report that they are Jews with no religion. Among those who do identify Jewishly, less than a third are raising Jewish children. 42% of self-identifying Jewish respondents believe that having a good sense of humor is more essential to their Jewish identity than traditional Jewish values. Now, not everybody agrees with this conclusion, but many looked at the report and concluded that the American Jewish community may be significantly threatened, and perhaps to a greater degree than any of us may have realized. This report, in addition to being of wide interest and of great controversy, is particularly important to this institution, the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. Pardes, for over 40 years, has been focusing tirelessly on engaging diverse young Jewish adults, mostly North American young Jewish adults, and connecting them with the learning and relevance of Judaism's traditions and texts. So we are intensely interested in what the Pew Report has to say and its profound implications, and we're very proud and very pleased to be able to sponsor tonight's panel. Let me briefly introduce our panelists, talk a little bit about what the format's going to be, and then turn it over to them. We're very privileged to have with us tonight a truly distinguished panel. We'll begin with a 25-minute presentation by Stephen Cohn. Stephen, in the middle, is, by all accounts, I think by unanimous acclaim, the preeminent sociologist of the American Jewish community. His work focuses and has always focused on that community. He's currently a research professor of Jewish social policy at Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion. He's also the director of the Berman Jewish Policy Archive at NYU's Wagner School of Public Policy. He's taught at Hebrew University, Queens College, and he's also a longtime friend of Pardes, and we're delighted to have Steve with us. To Steve's right is Rabbi Naama Kelman. Rabbi Kelman is a descendant of 10 generations of rabbis, and she was the first woman to be ordained by the Hebrew Union College in Jerusalem in 1992, where she currently serves as dean. She was born and raised in New York. She's lived in Israel since 1976 and has worked on community organizing, Jewish education, and the promotion and establishment of progressive and pluralistic Judaism for Israelis. And finally, Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Riskin, to my immediate right, probably known to all of you, a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik, founding rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue on the Upper West Side in New York, which he led for 12 years. Also the founding chief rabbi of the Israeli city of Efrat in the West Bank, and also chancellor of the Or Torah Stone Institutions, which, as you know, is a network of high schools, colleges, and graduate programs in the United States and Israel. So we will begin with 25 minutes or so from Professor Cohn. We'll then follow with 15 minutes each for our other two panelists, and then the floor will be open for questions. Thank you.
It really is a privilege to be speaking here to this wonderful crowd, but to be speaking at Pardes Institute, which I see in my own personal life and my research, has really brought so much Jewish leadership to American Jewry, to world Jewry, not least my wife, Rabbi Marian Lev Cohen, who's studied here before going, during the time you were studying for the rabbinate at Hebrew Union College. But we have many reasons to be thankful and grateful to Pardes, not least my basketball games with David Bernstein. Where are you, David? Right. And then, Rabbi Riskin, you and I, the last time we were on a panel together, I asked you to speak at the Melton Center for Jewish Education at the Hebrew University, because I regarded you then, I regard you now, as the preeminent community builder of our time. And I very much enjoyed your lecture then, but you may not remember that in the early 70s, I came to you to ask you whether you thought I should do a certain action inside the Soviet Union on behalf of Soviet Jewry, and it was a rather dangerous action. And you gave me the advice that the costs were not worth the benefits were not worth the possible risks. So I took your advice and I stayed in the United States and didn't go, which allowed me to have the joy and pleasure of having my good friend Rabbi Naomi Kelman and her brother Rabbi Levi Kelman marry Marion and myself in Yerushalayim some years ago. So actually, it all comes together. And
near the quest for worth the risks.
Right. So thank you all for enriching my life in so many ways, in this case, of preserving my life. I do want to speak about the Pew report. I've been spending a lot of time thinking about what this report means for American Jewry. And I'll say that in a certain level, unfortunately, it bears out the direction of analysis that I've taken over the last 20 years or so, my 40-year career. We've heard a few comments about the report already. I think one of the major contributions I can make is to focus on what I regard as the most critical finding to come out of the report. And that finding is a finding about the reduction in the number of non-Orthodox Jews, and particularly non-Orthodox engaged Jews in the United States. There are many other findings of some interest. Some were put there, frankly, in order to get journalistic attention. For some reason, the Pew researchers, and I was a consultant, I think I wrote one paragraph. They happened to like an email I sent them, so it's in there. But I had nothing to do with writing the report. But at the time they were with the report, they were concerned that maybe people wouldn't pay attention. As it turned out, people have paid more attention to this report than any other report they've done on any other particular group in the United States. They were rather surprised with the passion and vigor of their consultants, who spent as much time arguing with each other as we did with them about how to do the research. But the primary finding, putting aside all the interesting little cutesy, you know, pieces about humor and this and that, is that when you look at the results, you see that Jews who are not Orthodox, and I have no easy term to say what, you know, non-Orthodox Jews who are other than Orthodox, are declining in number in the United States. We've already seen a decline, and for lots of reasons that I'm going to mention, that decline will continue. Very simply, if you look at Jews who are middle-aged Jews who are not Orthodox, for every birth year, there are about 75,000 such Jews. When you look at children, non-Orthodox, we have 52,000 such Jews. There's a decline of 30% over a 40-year age span. Almost 1% per year. Why is this coming about? Why is it the case that non-Orthodox Jews are declining in number? There are several reasons. About half the reason can be attributed to fertility, to Jewish birth rates. On average, non-Orthodox Jews are having 1.7 children per couple. 1.7 is not enough to replace the population. The demographers want 2.1 to stay even. The 0.1 is because of some people are infertile, some women are infertile. So to get 2, you need 2.1. We're not getting 2.1, we're not getting 2. We're getting 1.7 out of the non-Orthodox population, which in and of itself would produce roughly 19% decline from one generation to the other. But the next problem is the 1.7 are not all Jews. They're not being raised as Jews. The 1.7 consists of, derives from many people who are intermarried, who are not raising Jewish children. In 1990, roughly 43% of American Jews who were marrying non-Jews. By the year 2000, the study that I worked on then, that number had gone up to 47%. Pew puts a little bit higher. But But we all agree that the Pew number for the last 5 or 8 years or so has now reached 58%. So 58% of Jews who married in the last 8 years are marrying non-Jews. So that's pretty serious. And then in the morning of, I guess it was October 1st, September 30th, I was being interviewed by the New York Times on behalf of the Pew Report. And we gave him the 58%. And then I hung up the phone. I said to Marion, I said, you know, it would be nice to have the percentage of non-Orthodox Jews who are intermarrying. That would be I'm sure that's a bigger number. If it's 58 for the whole population, maybe it's 62, 63, but that's really a critical number. So I called up Pew. I said, could you run me this number? Because I think it'd be very interesting. And at that point, they came back. They said, yeah, it's 72%. 72% of non-Orthodox Jews who married in the last 8 years married somebody who's not Jewish and has not converted. And, I mean, I was devastated before, and I was even more devastated after the fact. I was really, and I said, can I call the New York Times? I said, yeah, sure, go call them. It's a number. I called back the New York Times, and the Times made it the second headline, basically, that this was the number. So more than 7 out of 10 of non-Orthodox Jews are marrying non-Jews. So there's a machlekas in America about whether intermarriage in and of itself is a bad thing. I want to let you know that it exists, something that I take one side of that debate. But whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing, or it's a neutral thing, you can't dispute the fact that intermarried people produce fewer Jews. So just to give you a sense of what we have here, we know from the Pew study how many people who are the children of one Jew and one non-Jew themselves say that they're Jewish. The answer is 43%. 43% of people who had a Jewish parent and a non-Jewish parent say that they're Jewish. Now, it turns out, by the way, just to make life a little easier on us, you don't need 100% to stay even. You need only 50% of the children of one Jewish parent to stay even. That's because when two Jews marry, you use up two Jews. But when a Jew and a non-Jew marry, you only use up one Jew. So if you have two children married to non-Jews, then you only need one set of Jewish grandchildren to stay even. For the population. So you can feel, well, you know, Sonia is doing well, but Freddie, all right. But it balances out. So, right. So black humor, right. Although, all right, we'll leave it at that. So the 43% is not so terrible from a population point of view. I honestly think from a Jewish point of view, it's a tragedy, obviously. But it turns out the other problem, the 43%, is that from everything we have, these people are not, you know, as a group, there's some exceptions, obviously, these people are not being raised with as much Jewish education and socialization as the in-married parents. We have lots of evidence, and it's also in the Pew study, but from, you know, there isn't a study which says otherwise, that in-married parents, even if you take out the Orthodox, just say they're a different group. Let's just look at the non-Orthodox. If you just look at non-Orthodox Jews, in-married parents are far more Jewishly active than intermarried parents by any way you measure activity. There's no way you can measure activity. So the gaps are substantial, but not overwhelming with respect to Passover Seder or to belonging to a synagogue or to belief in God. There are differences there. The differences grow when you look at Jewish friendship. The differences are enormous when it comes to Israel. The major reason that younger Jews are less attached to Israel is that younger Jews more often derive from intermarried families, or they are intermarried themselves. Were it not for intermarriage, younger Jews would be just as involved with Israel as older Jews. I say this without any question. So intermarriage not only produces fewer Jews to some extent, but it produces Jews who themselves are not all that Jewishly engaged. How do we know? Because we can look at the people who already had non-Jewish parents and a Jewish parent, the children of the intermarriage. We can ask, well, how many of them are marrying non-Jews? And the answer is 83% of people who've married, who have not a Jewish, non-Jewish parent, they have married non-Jews. So if you look at, you kind of play these numbers out, right? You have the intermarried, 43% of the intermarried kids are Jewish, 83% of them marry non-Jews. That means 17% do marry Jews. 17% times 43% leaves you with 8%. 8% of these children, of the children of the intermarried, are married, are Jews married to Jews, which has direct consequences for the grandchildren. Harriet, where are you? So I just told Harriet, I Harriet Elazar, I happened to read Daniel Elazar's report on the 1990 Jewish National Jewish Population Study. And if I can just change a number or two, he said then what I'm saying now. What I'm saying now, what he said then, actually, is I owe my insights to Daniel Elazar and Marshall Sklar and Charles Liebman of old blessed memory. And Elazar, in this comment, reports what Milton Himmelfarb, another great thinker, who was an essayist for Commentary Magazine, worked for American Jewish Committee. He was asked, what do you call the grandchild of an intermarriage? He thought for a second. He said, Christian. And he's right 92% of the time, right? He's not 92%. So we have a situation of rampant intermarriage, few children to begin with, few children who are Jewish coming out of the intermarriages, and frankly, a declining population of non-Orthodox Jews. Last point about this. Because of all this, because of the defection of people from our midst, think about the following. There are 7.2 million adults, 18 and over, who have a Jewish parent, one or two. Of the 7.2 million, 5.1 million identify as Jews. Another 200,000 who converted. But 5.1 million identify as Jews. That means 2.1 million of the 7.2 million have a Jewish parent, but usually it's one Jewish parent, and they today, walking around in America, you meet these people, you have a Jewish parent, yes. Are you Jewish? No. 2.1 million such people are walking around in America. And my dear wife is a rabbi and runs a minyan. This is the minyan I don't have to pay for, but the one I go to most often. And the second one I pay for very little is Rabbi Levi Kelman's minyan in Kol Shema. But in Marion's minyan, there is no name, so I call it Marion's minyan. Other people call it whatever they want. It was held. We had a Shabbos service on Friday, October 5th. I remember the day. Jane Eisner was sitting in the room. Jane Eisner was one of the consultants from the Forward, who consulted with on the Pew study. And I looked at her, and Marion's rabbinic partner, Rabbi Larry Kaufman, said, "Okay, would anybody like to? If you're saying a mishaberach for somebody, let us know who you say mishaberach for." I felt a little bit strange. I don't know what to say, but it was in my heart. And I said, "Yes. I just found out that we lost 2.1 million Jews. I want to say mishaberach for American Jews. We're sick. We're really sick." And I really feel that that's the case. I want to convey this to you, how deeply I was moved, and I'm sure you were as well. So that's the situation on the Orthodox side. What about the non-Orthodox side? What about the Orthodox side? The Orthodox, the demography is totally punkt verkehrt, totally the reversed. on average, fertility rate of 4.1, hardly any intermarriage. The result is that the Orthodox are growing rapidly in number. Just to give you a few quick numbers, just to give you a sense of how fast we're talking about. Because of Orthodox growth and non-Orthodox decline, listen to the following. Of adults, 10% of American Jews are Orthodox. 1990 was 6.8. So that turns out to be a significant increase. But 10% is the number for adults today. Among children, what percent of Jewish children are Orthodox in America today? 27%. What percent of Jewish children under the age 5 are Orthodox? 35%. I'll give you one more number, which is kind of just goes up. Of those Jews who married Jews in the last 8 years, what percent are Orthodox? 53%. Most Jews who married Jews are Orthodox. Like I said, that the in-marriage coalition consists of Shas, Habayit HaYehudi, and Agudat Yisrael. That's the ruling party, or the ruling parties of in-married Jews in America today. That's what we got. And again, it's a testimony to the Orthodox demographic strength, which is terrific, and it should continue, which is not my concern here tonight. My concern is with the preservation of the diversity of American Jewish life and the continuity of American Jews. So the question is what we do about it. Most of, and this is the difference, this is where I'll part company with some very, very good people. Most people take from this pattern of results, we need to deliver a better Judaism. Somehow we're Jews don't understand, we have to do better education, we have to have better tefillah, we have better rabbis and better educators, all of which is a wonderful thing and should happen. From a demographic point of view, it won't help. It's not the issue. It should happen. The demographic question is affected primarily, it's in part by, if any of you are a criminal attorney, you taught a law school, didn't you? Where's Michael? You taught a law school.
Not criminal,
okay. Something interesting like estates or something. I don't know what you did. All right, mergers and acquisition. But all right. You need two things to you have to prove two things. There's motive and there's opportunity. When we talk about Jewish life, we talk about motive. We talk about giving people values. We talk about culture. We talk about tradition. We talk about all these wonderful things. We also happen to construct relationships. And since the reason I admire both Rabbi Naomi Kelman and Rabbi Shlomo Riskin is that what you're doing is you're creating relationships, you're creating and leading institutions, but we don't talk about that. And I think what for me, one of the lessons of the Pew Report is that we have to talk about the wonderful work we do in creating relationships and building and creating institutions, because in addition to the motives, we need the opportunities. Jews who marry Jews are not only motivated to marry Jews, may not only be motivated to marry Jews, they marry the people with whom they interact, which turns out to be, if they marry, they marry Jews, other Jews. I was speaking actually at Gretz College in Philadelphia a few weeks ago, and I said, you know, you guys in Philadelphia, you actually have a low intermarriage rate, a high in-marriage rate. And in San Francisco over there, they have a huge intermarriage rate. Now, if we thought that it's a matter of Jewish education and spiritual leadership and motivation and inspiration and spirituality and all that other stuff, we would have to conclude that the rabbis of Philadelphia are brilliant. They are the best educators in the world, because compared with the rabbis of San Francisco, who are horrible. But you know that's not true. I mean, like, with all due respect, the rabbis of Philadelphia. So the difference is that that Philadelphia Jewry is rather compact. Jews know each other. They're rather stable. They've been there for several generations. You go to San Francisco, and you find a very, very disparate community. I did a study in San Francisco of the readers of the J, which is the Jewish newspaper, and I got 1,400 respondents for my study. So the first thing I did what I do when I get a study is I look for neighborhood clusters. I look for zip codes. So I ran the zip codes for my 1,400 respondents. You know what? I got 1,400 zip codes. I got, like, not quite, but I got basically one Jew, one zip code. One zip code, one Jew, which is ridiculous. In other words, like, there isn't a Jewish neighborhood in San Francisco. It doesn't exist. And I asked, I said, no, well, maybe the East Bay, but maybe not. You know, maybe near Stanford, you know, where Arnie used to live. But it doesn't exist. And it's indicative of the lack of social connections, of the fiber that connects Jews. So what do I take from this? I take from this that we need to do a much better job of connecting Jews to one another. We can do this personally, as people, as parents and as grandparents, and we can do it institutionally. And here I'm going to wind up. Institutionally, here's what we need to do. It's really very simple. It costs only tens of millions of dollars. It's not a lot. No, I'm serious. We have it. We have philanthropists who are generous, who are balei tzedakah, who really care about Jews, who do things that other philanthropists don't. And my little dream is that we're going to create a movement. We're going to get this point across. I'm going to go to the philanthropists and say, here's what you got to do. You support youth groups? Terrific. Great. Support all the youth groups. Pour a million, Lynn Schusterman pours $3 million or so into B'nai B'rith Youth Organization. Your kosher food that you buy sends $10 million over to NCSY. Those are the two organizations that have significant outside funding. What about all the others? Why aren't we supporting youth groups? Trips to Israel. We do Birthright. It's wonderful. Age 18 and beyond. What about age 16 and 17, 15? We have not increased teen travel to Israel. What about Jewish camp? We have, what I'm told is, we've been successful in getting more kids into Jewish camps. We now have a bed shortage. The camps could have, we could have one, each new camp costs about $1 million to create. It doesn't have to be, bought and built. We can create 20 more new camps for $20 million. It's not a lot of money. 20 camps with 300 to 500 beds apiece. Why am I saying all this? Because we have evidence that each one of these experiences increases the intermarriage rate by 3 to 5%. Camps do it 10%. It really has an impact. It's really true. If Birthright's 10 days increases intermarriage by 40%, which I believe more or less does, why wouldn't you think it's true for camps, youth groups, and trips to Israel? Let's go on. Let's go on to the college campus. I went to Columbia. By this time, there ought to be the Columbia Law School Hillel worker. She doesn't exist. There should be the Columbia Business School Hillel worker. He doesn't exist. We ought to be having one Hillel worker for every 300 to 500 young people. That's not the case. Why don't we have that? It's not that much money. We could do that. Hillel or Hillel-like activities can connect people. What about now after college? We know where the Jews are, where the young Jews are. They live in places where there are not synagogues and other institutions, by definition. Why don't we flood those areas with organizers, with independent minyanim, film festivals, cultural events, cafes, all kinds of activities? Why don't we create Jewish development zones, as I call them, in Lower Manhattan and Brownstone, Brooklyn? What about when these people get married? A lot of them intermarry. We know that they've huge numbers of them intermarry. And here I have two proposals. One is that Michael Steinhardt should pay for young HUC, JTS, Hebrew College, YCT, maybe YU graduates if it works, but basically get young rabbis who are dedicated to performing conversions. Right now, there's a conversion institute at Central Synagogue. My back of the envelope estimate is that they're spending $120,000 to convert 30 people a year. That's $4,000 a convert. That's not bad. That's pretty good. Brad Arston's, I'm almost done. I gotta finish up? 2 minutes, no problem. Thank you. I asked for that. Brad Arston has a conversion institute that for $500,000 converts 230 people. It's $2,000 a convert. Why don't we do that? Some of you may know that I've floated a very, shall we say, unorthodox proposal that for those people who don't want to convert, they can become affirmed as Jews. They can go through Jewish cultural affirmation. Why do I want to do this? Like, it's a long story, but I want non-Jewish partners of Jews to say that they're Jewish. Why do I want that to happen? Because if they say that they're Jewish, their kids will think that they have two Jewish parents, and the kids will have no choice but to identify as Jews. I'm being really very, very, very straightforward about this. Last point, daycare. There's been a dispute about whether we can afford to launch Jewish-supported daycare. Some say it's ridiculous, it's $1 billion, it's not going to happen. Possible. Steve Nassiter of Chicago says, no, actually we can do it with incentives. We can get more Jewish parents into Jewish-sponsored daycare and preschools. We should experiment. We should try. There ought to be one in Brownstone, Brooklyn, one in Lower Manhattan, places like that. Why do we need Jewish-sponsored daycare? So that Jews and intermarried families will send their kids to Jewish-sponsored daycare and preschools. And as a result of those social networks, the intermarried parents will say, you know what? This is pretty good. Maybe I'll join a synagogue. Maybe this kid should go to some kind of Jewish school. Maybe this kid should be Jewish. Their decisions are very, very, very much up in the air. I should just let you know, when you speak to the Jewish parent and the non-Jewish parent in many homes, they'll give you different answers about whether the kid's Jewish. And it's not just that the Jewish parent's saying, Jewish, 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 and the non-Jewish parent says, no. No, Christian, Christian, Christian. Sometimes they cross over. And the Jew thinks they're raising the kids Christian. The Christian thinks, no, the kid's Jewish. These decisions are fluid. They're up in the air. We can change them. Bottom line is that with imagination, with generosity, with alarm, we can perhaps create a situation in which we react to these really horrifying statistics and begin to connect Jews to one another, and begin to change the demography. My last point is, but I mentioned alarm. For many, many years, Jewish leaders have more or less known about these trends, and they've chosen to speak in front of their donors and their communities and tell them, you know what, there's a lot of challenges out there, but we're meeting those challenges. There's a bright future ahead, and with this bright future, I want your help. That positive, encouraging, smiling, lovely, inspirational way of treating the Jewish people has failed. I think instead of that approach, and I have several friends who engage in that approach, I know them many, many years now, I respect them, I admire them, they do things that I could never do, I would like them to become alarmist and pessimistic. I want them to say, unless we change our ways, unless in a sense we do tshuva, that we will face a situation in which our children and our grandchildren will not have Jewishly committed playmates and community mates. That's the problem. That's the future we want to avoid. The only way we can avoid that future is to face up to it and to change our ways and to invest in creating more meaningful associations between Jews and Jews, especially young adult Jews. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Cohen. Now I'd like to call on Rabbi Kelman, who will speak for about 15 minutes, followed by Rabbi Riskin.
Okay, so I'm the non-Orthodox representative whose numbers are plummeting. I'm a Jewish woman who's only had 3 children, and my life's work is making Judaism compelling. I'm not sure what I have to say. After Stephen Cohen's very strong words, that the answer seems to be mostly in demographics. And I don't want to argue with him, Mori v'Rabbi, but I'm going to have to, and tell you that first of all, and most of all, I'm an lifelong optimist. And even though I think like a pessimist sometimes, as a Jew, I think we have to act like optimists. I think we Jews have faced much more critical and terrible and devastating moments in our history when we thought much more was lost and our ability to re-energize, recreate, and find new sources of renewal is probably the secret of our survival. So again, I cannot argue with the demographics. All I can say is that I am involved in making sure that we non-Orthodox Judaism remains vital, remains compelling, because I still think many, many, perhaps most American Jews, North American Jews, will not choose Orthodoxy and certainly not ultra-Orthodoxy, where the numbers wonderfully are growing. Fantastic. But I think what we do have to be concerned about is how do we look for the light, the hope, the sparks of great stuff going on in the non-Orthodox world and make the fire greater, make the heat greater. So, and again, I am not sure we can stop intermarriage, not because it's inevitable, but because this is what happens when we have become so successful in North America. When you sit across a library table at Princeton or Harvard or Yale or pick your university, and there's a wonderful American sitting across the table, and you're speaking and thinking great thoughts and ideas, and these things happen. How we in that unit hope and work that the non-Jew, and I'd say overwhelmingly these non-Jews are actually not active Christians. They're non-Jews, and how do we bring them into the Jewish community? And as far as women having more children, well, that's also an interesting challenge. Of course, it would be nice, and of course, that Jewish men would take that responsibility as well, because Jewish women in North America are among the most successful women, I think, in the Western world. You know the statistics. And I'm not sure they want to have more and more children, and particularly when there are none of the support systems of quality daycare, subsidized schools, et cetera, et cetera. So that is my initial response. I also want to give ourselves a kind of perspective on Pew. In other words, what do I take away from Pew? What are my takeaways? Because I'm not even sure now. I read part of the report. I read so many responses to the report that, you know, it's like Midrash. I don't even know what's part of the report anymore. So, yes, and some of the responses are already cliche. Like, okay, we all know it's a great wake-up call. Okay, wake up to what? Okay, but it's also a reaffirmation of a lot of what we know, and I agree a lot of these trends we've seen. And what's interesting also, I know, Steve, you'd agree, so much of these trends are happening in what we'd call liberal Christianity as well. America is sliding, or pick your whatever verb, into less and less religious observance. And we certainly see that in the Protestant denomination, and I have a feeling is in the Catholic denominations as well. America is increasingly becoming less religious, more cultural, more American, and Jews are part of that those processes as well. Okay. I think a takeaway that I take from this is no one should be gloating. No one. Not one denomination, not one group. We all have work to do. We have to roll up our sleeves, and no one should gloat. Who can predict what's going to be in another 50 years in either direction? No one should be smug. I think that's one of the biggest lotasses of Jewish life. Do not be smug. Do not be sure and self-satisfied. It's never good enough. Do not panic and do not despair. I'm despairing much more of a Judaism that's racist. I'm despairing much more of Judaism that's a segregationist. I despair that in the state of Israel, the gap between the rich and poor is one of the biggest in the world. What kind of Jewish state is that? If we're going to despair, I think we have to despair about some other really serious matters that go on in Jewish life, and of course take responsibility for it as well. So I think we have reasons to be optimistic when we read Pew, and of course we do have reasons to be pessimistic, and we heard them loud and clear from Steve Cohn. Yes, there is bad news for people like us that 42% of Jews feel that Jewish humor is more important than observing Jewish law. Only 19% think observing Jewish law is what makes them Jews. And again, what we're seeing is the rise of being Jewish as opposed to being religious. So, and when you look at the being Jewish group, 94% of Jews said they're proud to be Jewish. I mean, this, I think, is an amazing statistic in American Jewish life. Again, if you think back just a generation or two generations ago, that huge percentage of Jews are comfortable in their Jewish skin and proud to be Jewish. Again, this Judaism is something that we're going to have to figure out, if particularly if it tends to be less religious, less observant, then what does it mean to be a Jew? And it can't just be, you know, that we eat Jewish foods and live in certain Jewish neighborhoods. And so I think this is one of the greatest challenges. What will it mean to be Jewish in an environment that is welcoming, that's open, that allows Jews to be whatever they want? For one of the first times in Jewish history, how do we get across a message that you can be successful American and you can also be Jewish and you can also have a rich Jewish life? Yes, Jews should be marrying Jews. We know that. And maybe all Jews should live in the Northeast where there are more Jews, and maybe all Jews should go to the universities where there are more Jews. But again, these things are not necessarily going to happen. And we have to prepare ourselves for an American Judaism that's changing before our eyes, shifting before our eyes, and I do not see it only as bad news. I think it's an opportunity. I think we have to understand there are radical shifts happening. Just think of the shifts of the 20th century. What happened to North America? It's almost amazing when you read the positive. So the waves of immigration, the devastation of the Holocaust, the rise of Zionism, of course, and liberal Judaism and feminism. Unbelievable what's happened. The earthquakes that have happened, good and bad, in American Jewish life. And it's, in my mind, amazing and a gift that we still have a vibrant, vibrant Jewish community, even among the non-Orthodox. Having said that, I still believe we have to be brutally honest. I said we shouldn't be smug. We should not. We also need to be brutally honest with ourselves. What do we do with increasingly decentralized Judaism, boutique Judaism, do-it-yourself Judaism, when we have these big centralized organizations? Okay, what do we do with all our real estate in North America, where huge suburban synagogues can't be filled anymore? What are we supposed to, how do we do that? How do we rethink? How do we remodel? How do we recreate? And I know there are people thinking about this all the time. I'll give you just two examples. In the city of Boston, where you have some of these big suburban synagogues that can't fill the pews, or they only fill them on the high holidays, they're asking themselves, well, maybe we have to literally tear the big structure down, build Batei Midrash, build assisted living, build Jewish community center on the grounds of said synagogue. I think we have to rethink how we bring people into our institutions, because fewer and fewer are going to come in to pray. More and more are going to come perhaps to live in assisted living, attend festivals, cultural centers, etc. Around the corner from the synagogue actually I'm thinking about is something called Maim Chaim. That is an incredible mikveh founded by non-Orthodox Jews in America. Who would have thought that non-Orthodox Jews would create an incredible mikveh? By the way, it's now becoming also a national program. And they are full all year long, with people coming for all sorts of reasons, not just for family purity, but before wedding, every moment, different moments of life cycle, men, women, of course, conversion, bat mitzvah, graduation. It's become a movement. And here, who would have thought that non-Orthodox Jewry be interested in something like this? And they've transformed it to a meaningful and compelling place, a community. Now again, not dues paying, not community, but great Jewish stuff, great creative Jewish stuff happening. And I could give more and more examples of these kind of local initiatives, the entrepreneurial Judaism, where there are tremendous sparks of vitality that we just have to nurture and cultivate. And again, I agree with Stephen, daycare. We have to target ages 15 to 17, which are the crucial, crucial years. And I know that the reform movement is pouring all its money at the moment into that. How do we really hold on to these kids 15 to 17, where they make, it turns out, many of their life decisions? Many years ago, my father, who was actually a leader in the conservative movement, talked about when, again, people were bemoaning the state of Judaism, that we have to keep looking for the sparks of revitalization. Where are the sparks? Where are the sparks? And again, I'm talking about mostly the non-Orthodox world. And in the 1980s, he already identified what he felt was the rise of Jewish feminism, which I think we can all agree has transformed Judaism across the entire spectrum, including, I think today, some of the most exciting things happening in Orthodox Jewish feminism, particularly in Israel. Jews by choice, tremendous source. Those Jews who've actually come into our midst and chose to be Jews. And even I would add today, those non-Jews raising Jewish children, they are a tremendous source of vitality and renewal. Also in the 1980s, my father saw a trend where he felt children and grandchildren of survivors, those who survived the Holocaust, offered a great source of creativity. And again, to defying the odds, they would revitalize Judaism. And I invite all of us to look, to see, to listen. Where are the sources of revitalization? And I could say a moment when I look at the Jewish world today, I see the explosion of Jewish music, Jewish film, poetry in Hebrew and English, you name it. And I mentioned, of course, now Orthodox feminism, I think, is radically transforming Judaism as well. And because they're in dialogue also with the non-Orthodox. I see the third and fourth generation Israelis reclaiming Jewish life in ways that, again, none of these things we thought possible. So I hesitate to take a snapshot and say the end is near. I just can't say that. Just I look at my students at HUC, many of them now products of intermarriages who were raised as Jews. They have one non-Jewish parent. Their commitment, their passion. These are kids who've been exposed to the best of Jewish worlds on campuses today, all over in our summer camps. They feel as comfortable singing a Karlbach nigun as they do a nifty song, etc. I think we cannot dismiss this. I think that it's a tremendous source of vitality. I will not. They are an opportunity to get to people who would not be opposed to be raised as Jews, or certainly not be supposed to have their children be active Jews. And I see this all the time among my student body. Maybe it doesn't hold up in the statistics, but anecdotally, I am encouraged all the time. So again, I'll just end with this, that I look back 67 years ago. I picked a date just thinking as I was preparing. 1946, what did the Jewish world look like in 1946? With devastation, total devastation of Eastern European Jewry. No state of Israel, a vulnerable US Jewry, okay? And what's happened in these 67 years? What has happened? Vibrant Jewish day, over 7 million Jews, a flowering of US Jewry, universities, scholarships, communities, you name it, a creativity nonstop. So I'd like to say, let's keep the Pew study, let's keep it in perspective, okay? We are not an ever-dying people. We are ever-living, ever-flowing, ever-renewing Jewish people. Thank you.
Erev Tov. It's truly a pleasure to be here. This is the first time I find myself on a panel in which I totally agree with both speakers.
You're wrong.
You're right. That's the rabbinic answer. You're right, and you're right.
And you're right also. I fundamentally buy all of the program suggestions of Professor Cohen, And I also accept the optimism of Rabbi Kelman. I remember in the 60s, Look magazine, headlined article, The Vanishing American Jew. 3 years later, Look magazine vanished. American Jewry was pretty strong. So, the programs that you suggest, Professor Cohen, are great. The optimism, I believe, of Rabbi Kelman is correct. I'm not at all upset about Pew. I'm not at all upset about Pew because I truly believe that nothing is new in what Pew said. I also remember in the 50s reading a fascinating article by Maurice Samuels, who was one of the very, very important literati of American Jewish life, translator from Yiddish, sociologist, fascinating individual. And he said something I've never forgotten. He wrote, quoting Josephus, that at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple, after the destruction, there were 10 million Jews left. If you make some kind of a statistical study, how many Jews should be alive today from those 10 million Jews? The answer was something like 400 million. Now, let's say 50% would have been destroyed by persecution. After all, Hitler only managed with all of his machinery to destroy a third, but let's say 50%. There should be 200 million Jews today. There are barely 13 million. What happened to them? They went the way of the Pew Report. That's how it's been throughout Jewish history. And the reason is, I think what the Pew Report should get us to face is a very important principle that makes the road difficult, but not any different than it's been for at least the last 2,000 years. Let me give you a personal experience that maybe will put what I believe very much in perspective. I went to Germany for the first time, actually. I had taken a vow many years ago never to step foot into Germany. We never took anything from Germany into our home. And then I got an amazing visit from the Order of the Sister of Miriam from Darmstadt, outside of Frankfurt. And they came to Efrat with a gift. They read my article every Shabbat. They wanted to give me a gift, a tapestry, a beautiful tapestry. For the sake of Jerusalem, I will not be silent. Anyway, they told me they have a place called New Canaan, and they would like me to come, and I could dedicate Efrat in New Canaan in Germany. And if I want to understand what they're talking about, I should please come. And they give me a $50,000 gift for the study hall in Efrat. Listen, everybody has his price. Mine is not that expensive. And the truth is that I was thinking for a very, very long time about visiting Germany because I had then 7 rabbis in Germany and I have now 11 rabbis in Germany. And German life, German Jewish life, is experiencing a real renewal. Anyway, I went to see them. I saw New Canaan, Jordan River, stones, beautiful kibbutz, 12 stones with each of the 12 tribes, little towns, clumps of houses. This was Bethel. This was Jerusalem. This was Efrat. I dedicated Efrat. I finished speaking to a very, very large group, 140 nuns and 60 monks, and they all stood up and sang the Hatikva in Darmstadt, Germany. And it was started by seven friends whose fathers were from the Wehrmacht, and they wanted to make up for the sins of their fathers. It was an amazing trip. However, the most important thing is the day before the trip. I was actually invited, and it all worked out about the same time, to go to the University of Munich and to give a lecture on the names of God. They'd invited me before to do it. I'd refused. I don't go to Germany. This time, I got the request again from the head of the Department of Theology at the University of Munich, and I decided to take him up on the offer. And I went. And I came Sunday morning. I arrived late Sunday morning, and the lecture was only on Monday, and then I was going to go to Darmstadt, and then I was going to visit with my students. It was a beautiful day, and I started walking. And I walked all around Munich, and there was something very strange, very, very weird, bothering me. And I realized what it was. I didn't see any children. And I kept on walking, and I went to parks, and I asked people about parks. I always, in Germany, and I've gone back a number of times, I speak Yiddish. It works. I understand them. They understand me, pretty much. I even began to go into restaurants. I saw one restaurant where there was a man, a woman, and a strapped dog. And the dog was eating with a bib. Then came a few parks, and I did see a few children, but very, very few. The next evening, I gave my lecture. And the head of the department introduced me, and he said before he introduces me, he had tried to ask me to come a number of times, and I had refused the invitation. I had never wanted to come to Germany. He would like to think what I think about Germany. And I told him what I'm telling you. No children. It upset me very much. And in a frat, our major product is our children. And then he said something I've never forgotten. I wrote it down. I've never forgotten it. He said as follows, quote, "We in Europe," it's not just Germany, it's Europe, "we in Europe are not interested in expending money and energy on creatures we cannot control who make dirt and noise," unquote. But then I began, I was trembling. I was literally, literally trembling. But then I began to think a little. European community is dying. The whole European community, he was right. The European Union has sort of, talk about that in a second. But Europe is laying dead and allowing Islamabad to take over. No children. England, France, Amsterdam, all over. And when you think about it logically, you know, in times gone by, if you wanted to have sex, you had to have children, more or less. That's not an issue anymore. And children are difficult. And sometimes they listen, and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they give nachas, and sometimes they give a lot of pain. And they cost a lot of money. And they don't always say thank you. And it's easier without. I'm going to say something I believe with all my heart. Unless you have what is for you a compelling narrative that you want to give over to the next generation, it is becoming increasingly illogical to have children. And it's only those people, and those civilizations, European Union meant that individual societies no longer felt the need for that individual national compelling narrative. And throughout the last, especially 2,000 years after the destruction of the Second Temple, the Jews who preserved Judaism, it was the minority of Jews, but it was the Jews who felt this compelling narrative that they felt they had to give over to the next generation. And that was the most important reason for their being. Without that, there's no future. Without that, there's no Judaism. And there has to be a Judaism which is meaningful, and meaningful for humanity. That's basically my story. And I want to add only one more thing. You know, I live in Israel, Baruch Hashem. And Israel is a very exciting and very multivariegated kind of society. And even in Efrat, we have black Ethiopian Jews. And we have brown Indian Jews. And we have darkish Moroccan Jews. And we have fairly dark Russian Jews. And we have very light Scandinavian Jews. And it tells me one very strong thing. There always was intermarriage. That's why every Jew looks like the people who live in the area from which he comes. If we think that intermarriage is a new issue, we are totally fooling ourselves. And that means that Judaism has survived, not through DNA and not through Jews marrying Jews. Judaism has survived when people adopted a Jewish lifestyle which they felt was so meaningful and so important that it had to be transmitted to the next generation. Now, this is not an Orthodox triumphalist speech, because I don't feel that way. Because I believe it has to be a meaningful Judaism, and it has to be as inclusivistic as it can be, and as universalistic as it can be. And yes, Orthodox Jews are marrying Jews. But very many of my Orthodox brothers and sisters, their main problem is in which homes I cannot eat. And how to separate myself, which forums I cannot speak, because how can I talk in a forum where there may be someone who doesn't agree with the usual brand of Orthodox Judaism, witness Limud. The most important educational enterprise, maybe throughout the diaspora in the last 50 years, but certainly in England. And my Orthodox brethren were only afraid they would be legitimizing the Reform and the Conservative if they went to Limud. So the end story is that the Orthodox delegitimized themselves because nobody gave a damn as to whether they were there or they weren't there, and that it would have had a tremendous opportunity to teach Judaism to so many people who didn't really know about Judaism. But instead, they chose to boycott it, so their presence weren't at all felt. That's not the way we're going to get more real Jews. I believe that conversion is a tremendous opportunity. I'm not crying over it. And as I said, assimilation and intermarriage characterized us in spades during the last 2,000 years. So I think we have to change our whole attitude about intermarriage. At least when people are thinking of intermarrying, they're thinking about Judaism. A Jew and a Christian don't intermarry. A lapsed Jew and a lapsed Christian. An alienated Jew and an alienated Christian. Those are the two who are getting married. And all too often, they're not thinking at all about religion. But when then the specter of intermarriage comes up, and maybe I would love to see Ulpanim teaching Judaism, and we're starting it. We're really starting it. And conversion courts that are embracing, not a 10 kind of lesson, hour lesson conversion. It doesn't mean anything, because if it's not going to be a meaningful Jewish experience, it's not going to be communicated to the next generation. It's not going to be worth it. But if you use this as a means of teaching the magnificent values of Judaism that the world needs desperately, Shabbat with the creation of the human being in God's image, Pesach with what freedom really should mean all over the world for every human being, Sukkot, that it's not the big house that counts, but it's the house with love and traditional values, the Ushpizin and the Ushpizot. The universalism of Sukkot. And a Judaism that has to speak to the world and embrace the world and engage the world. I think we could turn the statistic around, and through intermarriage, instead of losing Jews, we could gain many Jews with real seminars. And I wouldn't concentrate on denominations. I think the conversion centers have to be trans-denominational. I don't care about where you go to pray. One of the most difficult things in the world is prayer. However it works, let it work. And I want to tell you a very sad thing. For a rabbi, that is maybe a new thing that most people don't know, but it's really true. One of the least important institutions for the history of Judaism is the synagogue. So who cares whether it's Orthodox, Reform, Conservative, or Reconstructionist? Teach living, experiential, familial Judaism. The family is under attack in Western culture. But I believe deeply and profoundly in the family. And Judaism has a magnificent way of bringing the family together. And concentrate on really what is important in experiencing and living Judaism. Make Shabbos a verb, not only a noun. Make Judaism an alive and vital and enjoyable experience, and try to embrace the non-Jew as well as the Jew. I believe with all my heart that we can turn the statistic around. And if we concentrate on what Judaism is really about, I think Judaism can become the kind of world religion that Abraham made it, meant for it to be. Through you, God said to Abraham, all the families of the earth will find blessing. And I think we'll find that if we understand that only a Judaism that's meaningful can be passed on to the next generation, the Pew Report can be a very critical and positive wake-up call. Thank you very much.
I want to thank our distinguished panel for these really remarkable and compelling remarks. Just a footnote before we open the floor to questions. We're sitting in the Beit Midrash of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For 41 years, we've been welcoming an incredibly diverse group of young Jews, mostly from North America, to learn in this Beit Midrash at Pardes. They are overwhelmingly non-Orthodox. They're young. We track them very carefully, and we know that at this point in the history of the institution, we've graduated 6,200 of them. We know that over 1,000 are rabbis and others in Jewish professional life. And most importantly, in terms of the topic of discussion tonight, we know that well over 90% of them marry other Jews, raise their children as Jews, and are deeply involved in Jewish life. So we at Pardes share the optimism that we've heard, which is not to say that we aren't concerned and alarmed about some of the statistics that we see in the Pew report, but it does show, as I think Rabbi Kelman and Rabbi Riskin are suggesting, that there are some things that we know can work. So with that, let's open the floor to questions. We'll take about 10, 15 minutes of questions. Yes.
Conservative, those that are that say that they are conservative or reform must at some time feel some affiliation, meaning that at some time or other they go to a synagogue. And Rabbi Riskin said it doesn't matter what kind of synagogue. The fact is that there are synagogues controlled or at least guided, let's say, by JTS, by Hebrew Union College. That synagogue and those few precious moments, be it just three times a year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, or four times a year, Yisker, is when the rabbi has this congregation, little congregation, even for a brief period of time, all for himself. And it seems to be that it's a role of the HUC and JTS to utilize that time and that opportunity.